first of all, the personal evolution you have to go through when you're building your own life from nothing, the personal evolution you have to go through when there's no one to rely on, there's no one to call. It feels at this point like a superpower because no one can take anything away from me that I can't get back.
What's up, everyone? You're listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. The purpose of this show is to share stories of hardship and victory as an encouragement for those in the middle of their own hard thing. Because we know hardship produces perseverance, which produces character, which ultimately produces hope. Today's guest is Molly Rucker. Molly is an avid trail runner, self-made philosopher, and the co-founder of Keto Brains. Molly shares growing up obese, turning to anorexia to make herself feel better, and the journey that led her to understand the chemicals in her brain and her ability to manage them towards a greater self-control. She reminds us that our circumstances do not need to define our outlook, and we have more agency to shape our present moment than we actually realize. If you enjoy the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review so more people can be encouraged by the stories we share. Now here's the conversation with Molly Rucker. Okay, we got Molly Rucker on the Do Hard Things podcast. Super excited to have you. I can tell you've done some thinking about this subject, which will benefit, I think, everybody listening. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I think this is going to be one of my most favorite conversations this month. Don't get to chat on this topic with many people. So excited. Yeah. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah. Well, let's give people context for who you are. And yeah. I like to do that by asking the question, when people ask you what you do, how do you answer them?
Yeah. So too many things at the moment. I'm currently director of innovation for a company working on supplement formulations and different functional foods in my day job. I also have a small business with my brother. It's called Keto Brains Nootropics. It's a ketogenic nootropic creamer with functional doses of alpha-GPC, L-theanine, and lion's mane. So it stands all by itself as a nootropic creamer. I'm sorry, as a nootropic that happens to be a creamer.
Yeah.
And that takes up all of our spare time because it's growing faster than we can keep up with. But in general, my focus in whatever day job I have with the business that we're building is optimal health, optimal functionality. I want my brain to be as clear as possible. I want to wake up in the morning and love the day that I'm living. Everything I do is towards the end of growing, evolving, getting better, learning. It's not perfect. You know, I'm human. We fail. It doesn't always work. But I'm all about incorporating the physical, nutraceutical, dietary, and thought processes that can get me to a place where I feel good about the time I have on this planet. Because, you know, we don't know why we're here. We don't know where we came from, but we're here and we need to own it. And I do my best to own it every day.
Yeah. So it sounds like you have a lot of purpose that you're attempting to live for in your life, not necessarily even just this season, but like overall. Before we get into that, because that's interesting in and of itself, you said lion's mane was a thing that was in this Keto Brains product. You have to clear that up because I hear lion's mane and I think literal lion's mane, but correct. I can't imagine that's what it actually is.
No animals were harmed in the creation of Keto Brains. Lion's mane is a medicinal mushroom. It's this beautiful medicinal mushroom and it has compounds in it that increase something called BDNF and NGF. So BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. NGF is neurotrophic growth factor. This is something that we want maximal amounts of in our brain for the healing of neurons, myelin sheath, Genetically, we each have a different SNP that codes for how much of this we're going to naturally produce. So you can have someone who just produces a really nice amount of BDNF naturally. You can have someone who's in the middle, and you can have someone who has low amounts. So lion's mane is something we can ingest that will increase BDNF. So we're increasing the ability of our neurons and brain cells to heal and to function better. Among many other things, it helps to potentiate a bit of serotonin and dopamine.
Yeah.
Lion's mane is lion's mane is wonderful. Sorry.
Yeah,
so
super interesting.
Not an animal, a wonderful mushroom.
Yeah. Good to know. So for people who aren't familiar with the company that you and your brother own, Keto Brains, can you talk a little bit about, like, because people are able to start a company, you know, theoretically, and do anything.
Yes.
But you guys decided, you know, to have this neurotropic focus, and where and why did that, like,
the genesis
come about? Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been in the wellness supplement health space for over 20 years now. My brother is 5 years younger than me, and over all of that time, you know, myself and him, we have been the guinea pigs. I learn about a new molecule, I learn about a new supplement, I figure out how to incorporate it, and we incorporate it, and we figure out if it's the right thing for us or if it's not. And over many years of trying all the things, trying all the nootropics, trying all the brain food, about 5 years ago now, I had a buddy who just would not stop texting me to listen to this episode of Joe Rogan. And I love Joe Rogan, I listened to him, but I didn't have time. About a week into him bugging me, I listened to this episode where Dom D'Agostino was on Joe Rogan for the first time, where he dove into the science of the ketogenic state and ketones. And it was just this massive light bulb for me that evolutionarily, this is the state we're supposed to be in probably most of the time. Because, I mean, where on earth are on the savannah 250,000 years ago, are you finding some carbohydrates every day? You're just not. And in that scenario, you would also be hungry most of the time. But in the ketogenic state, you are clearer, sharper, and more focused without food, without carbohydrates. So that, you know, propelled me down the keto rabbit hole. I stopped eating all carbohydrates. I was in deep ketosis 3 days later, and I was like, this is a gear I've never experienced in my life. I didn't have a brain issue before. My brain worked just fine. But the fact that there was a gear, a function gear that I didn't even know existed in my own physiology was just magic. And really, the reason we went with Keto Brains is our end product, we would often joke with one another that we wanted there to be more fun brains to play with. So Kyle and I are close. We've lived together over the years, and we would just entertain ourselves. We'd get a bottle of wine and just philosophize. We, you know, talk about existence, talk about life, like talk about the amazing things. And we would just kind of giggle and be like, well, you know, maybe we can feed people stuff that'll make them like happier and more excited. So kind of in the background, it was like, and this was our tagline for a minute, was we make good brains better. And the idea was you don't need to have any sort of cognitive deficiency to get greater benefit out of life, greater clarity out of life, greater functionality out of life. And this wonderful little combination of ingredients was our answer to that. But yeah, we decided to do it. It came out of years of us, you know, trying things, using things, creating what felt like a magical beverage.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing the story and congrats on the success. I'm sure that is a great reward for the risk that you took and all of this, because one of the questions I want to ask you is like, have you always known you were super interested in like brain molecules when did that kick in your life? And it's because it sounds like you've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
Here's the culmination.
I mean, really, I would say that story starts with, I was a fat kid. I was an obese teenager. I was a total geek. Art and English were what I thought I loved. I spent, you know, 14 to 24, this is sad, but at 14, I discovered anorexia in home ec in a video that was to teach us how bad eating disorders were. But as a fat kid, it was like an answer. So, So, you know, from 14 to 24, just really, you know, lost a bunch of weight, started to live at the gym, ate no fat. I'm 46. So when I was a teenager in the 90s, fat was the enemy, you know, so it was, you know, all the things. So for me, I think it really started with, I thought I was looking for health. I thought I was looking for health. I understand now, you know, having been a fat kid, then being obese, I was looking for skinny. And first I had to understand skinny wasn't health. Then I had to go through the process of understanding, well, what does health mean to me? How do I find it? How do I be nicer to myself? What is it to be nicer to myself? And that's when I think I started to kind of think about the effect that people or food or dogs or you name it, everything we come in interaction with has an effect on our brain state. So when you start thinking about that, like first it was, I lived in Boston for a while. I waitressed, I bartended, and I lived at Copley Library, and I got into epistemology for a minute. You know, what is knowledge? What is wisdom? Where does it live?
Yeah.
It all kind of started with a philosophical bend that eventually led to, well, what is happy? Well, happy is a stew of neurochemicals and hormones. So happy, like if you think about it as a female, you have a cycle and you feel different things during different times. So we've got, you know, we've got dopamine and we've got acetylcholine, and we've got GABA, and we've got serotonin, then we've got estrogen and testosterone. Each thing that we feel is this magical stew of neurotransmitters and chemicals and hormones. So if we can understand a little bit about that, perhaps we can understand a little bit about how to dial those things for ourselves based on what we're feeling. And it started for me with simple things. I noticed that raw cacao made me feel amazing. So you hear people say, X makes me feel this. Okay, let's dig deep. Once I started to understand this is, I love this. So our brains are basically pharmacies. Our brains are chemical manufacturers, right? Any drug, substance, oxytocin, you can ingest it. You can hug your dog. You can get it a lot of ways. We have receptors for all of these things in our brain. That's why a drug feels like a thing. That's why a supplement can feel like a thing. If we didn't have a receptor for oxytocin, I don't know that we would feel oxytocin. So once I kind of understood that, what that all equaled to me was that I wanted to get to a place where I didn't feel whipped around by my own biology and evolutionary history to the best of my ability, right? How much agency can I take over how I feel on a moment-to-moment basis? And once I learned that I didn't have to be whipped around by my own biology, which I think is what I felt during that eating disorder time, I think of an eating disorder as akin to an addiction, because there's a chemical addiction to an act that is making you feel good, but it's not making you healthy. Yeah. So I think that spun me into trying to figure out, how do I own my own self? How do I own my own brain chemistry? And, you know, once I went down that path, it's the lens through which I see existence now. It's the lens through which I see people. And it gives you agency when you have even just a little bit of understanding. To me, you'd be hard pressed to find someone who wasn't excited about the notion of taking some sort of agency over their day. We're okay. We're not dying. Mm-hmm. Just kind of keep reframing the reactivity.
That's okay, because it's all new information to me. So comment on the agency thing a little bit. I think there is a statement kind of in culture, like, we want control. I think it would be silly to say that people wouldn't admit that that's true. But it just kind of like, where we go to try to find it is all over the board, you know, like probably more common than anything is financial control, or, you know, some form of security and control over your circumstances through money. But you know, like everybody's looking for it in some way, shape or form, whether it's relationally, dietarily, And
but this is the number one.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. It's like the external circumstances you just can't actually control. And really there is like an opportunity to, it sounds like, because of these different chemicals that exist and understanding of how our brain works more and more, to do something in your thought life that you can't do out here. Like you just can't make it happen here when you're playing around over here.
No, it's, think about the amount of time and effort we spend to earn the money to buy a thing, an expensive thing, like a house or a car. And now we have to have insurance for that house and that car. And we do maintenance on that house and that car. And we don't want anybody to steal our house or our car. When do we protect our mind space in the same way? When do we protect our mind space from, whether it's from media, from maybe family members that are negative, from work situations that are negative? It's just crazy to me that we would never just like, you know, drop our wallet on the floor and walk away or leave the keys in the ignition with the door open. But we do that with our own mind spaces on the regular. And what you said is correct. At the end of the day, the only thing we can have even a modicum of control over is how we respond to what comes into our mind spaces while we're alive. What tools are we given as kids or teenagers or adults or guidance to learn how to ingest and respond? Everything these days is react. Emotion is king. Emotion is real. Emotion is real. It's like a check engine light. It tells us things. Listen to it. Step in with it. But it's not law. It's information, right? Like totally. I always go back to like a tattoo analogy. Like I've got both sides of my rib cage tattooed, and yes, that shit hurt. But it's this reframing. This is what a tattoo feels like. This is what a tattoo feels like. I don't need to run screaming from it. I've not only do I not need to run screaming for it, I'm paying for it. It's right. So. You know, you're doing your thing. You walk outside and your neighbor just says something just mean to you, right? So that causes you to feel a thing. So that thing is a stew of chemicals and hormones, but it has a half-life. So it's something like 90 seconds it takes for that thing you're feeling, it's a real thing, to cycle through your whole system and for you to be able to go, all right, that guy must be having a bad day. But what we do is we focus in on that negative thought, which can only continue if we feed it. So we've got this thing we call anger and emotion over here. And if we just give it 90 seconds to go through the system, it's going to go away. But what the human brain loves to do is go, oh, someone did a thing. We're mad. Let's make more mad chemicals. And then it can spin you out for a whole day, a whole week, a whole month, a whole year, if it's like a relationship, whatever it is. And just hearing her talk about that and how she got through it, like I never forgot that, because it's literally, it's a substance, if you will, that is going to cycle through your body if you let it go. But we tend to feed it. We don't let go of things. And if we could just learn to let go, we could get through all sorts of hard things easier.
Yeah. Wow. All right. It's so interesting. The 90 second thing, right? I can't remember who I was talking to somebody else that we're back concept that like there is a expiration date on this thing.
Yes.
And you just have to make it that long. And to be able to reframe your difficult situation as, okay, it's only 90 seconds. I can do 90 seconds.
Yeah.
And you know, it's the same kind of idea as like just one foot in front of the other. It's just how do you like break things into bite-sized manageable pieces?
Yep.
Because when you think about difficult things or emotional things, we tend as humans to look at them in their biggest possible state, you know?
It's overwhelming.
And it's super overwhelming. So it doesn't work and it doesn't do us any good. So
no, even, you know, little things, whether it's, you know, I don't know, like my ice bath, we keep it at 32 degrees. I can't think about that.
Oh my goodness.
I can't even think about I'll watch myself. I can see myself in my head. I'll be like, I'm going to get the ice bath. And then I start thinking about it. And I see myself like walking away from where I'm going. So it's just like, stop the thinking, do the thing. Or, you know, my brother and I were doing mountain trail running races for a period of time. And towards the end, I didn't have time to train. I had no business running these things. And this is not sound, I would not do it, but I just didn't think about it until the day I was there. And then it's 4 a.m. you're in the back country, it's freezing, you're running, and you have no idea how you're going to finish 30 miles. And, wasn't pretty, but I finished. Yeah. But you really can't, like, it's one step at a time. It's one step at a time. And it's always, as we briefly talked about earlier, you can always tap into something that you or someone else has been through that was so much more difficult. And the other thing I love to do is when we were training for mountain runs, we'd be doing one of our, like a 14 to a 20 mile run. I'd be like, what am I doing? Why am I out here? And then I'd go, wait a minute. This is like 3 or 4 hours of my life. I work 8 hours a day for someone else, and it's not epic at all. This is 4 little hours of my life that I own by myself in the mountains. And that would always reframe it. It's like, this is my job today. My job today is to grab these miles. And that it still works. Even, you know, I can't complain about my current situation because I do work remotely, but those times where you're like, you know, there's always those times where you're like, why am I working for these people? Why am I doing this? And it's like, no, let's reframe. Like, you got it pretty good. You know, you've got your dogs on the bed. There's always a reframe that we can do. And yeah, both the little things and the big things, because a big thing is nothing more than a bunch of little things that you consistently decided to knock off the list and keep moving forward. And, you know, thinking about a business, when I start thinking about how overwhelming it is to figure out how are we going to come up with this giant chunk of money to move production to this facility to do this, you just want to quit. And then a customer will write in with some wonderful email about how it's changed their lives, and it brings it all back down to, you know what? No, we can produce, we can keep producing where we're producing. We'll get to that big thing when we get there. But it's, yeah, my brother and I both have this tattoo that,
what's it say?
Well, we both have love and play, on our wrists, but it's like a swirly thing. Basically, it came from, the Four Agreements. I got tired of California when I was 21 and took a train to Boston and landed in Boston.
Train, right?
I've done it a few times, very long. Wouldn't recommend it, but it was cool back then. And so I was just on my own in Boston. My brother was on his own in Santa Barbara. I was waitressing, oddly enough, at this adorable little couple who were both lawyers who went to Brown University. They had taken a vacation to the Southwest and loved the Cocopelli. So in like the most Jewish part of Brookline, they opened Cocopelli's, this Southwestern restaurant. And I was waitressing there on Christmas. And I get this phone call. I didn't have a cell phone. My brother called me, you know, on the bar phone. Yeah. And it's like, sister, I'm on the beach. There's this book. It's called The Four Agreements. You need to go buy it tomorrow. And at that time, borders still existed and I lived in them. So the next day, I bought The Four Agreements. And, you know, it hit both of us hard at that time in a really good way. So we ended up designing a tattoo around it. But the swirl in the middle, to bring it back, you know, in life, we spiral in and focus inward. And then sometimes we have to spiral out and see the whole picture. And we can't stay out here all the time. And we can't stay in the middle all the time. We have to get nimble with when it's crucial to spiral back in and check in with ourselves and our lives and where we're going, and then not get stuck in there and spiral back out and be a part of a community and, you know, see what's happening out here. And, you know, I attempt to live by my tattoo, but
yeah, I wear this bracelet that says pray, and that's right. I like regularly think that should probably remind me to do that more. You know, it's like, that's the intention. And it's like,
we need a tattoo on our foreheads. It's like, right. You know, like how often am I like, let me see, am I doing it?
Yeah, it's like I'm so used to having it that it's just like there, but it's like intention and purpose is kind of lost on me. You know, it's like I don't see it. I just see, you know what I mean?
It almost helps when people point it out because it's like, oh, I need to hold myself to this thing that is tattooed on my body. Yes.
Right. Oh, yeah, I got that for a reason. I should utilize that. Yeah, totally. Well, so there's so many good things we could talk about. But I want to hear, so, you know, I'm going to ask the central question, the hardest thing in your life that you wouldn't take back.
Oh,
you mentioned ahead of time, like there's so many hard things.
Right.
And it is relative. So I'll just kind of like couch it all with like hard is relative and to individuals in their seasons of life that they are a part of and individual to individual. And, but at the same time, the human experience of like going through difficult things, overcoming, growing, character development, all of that is like spans all of it. And so I'm curious for you, Molly, what maybe how you would answer that question.
If you enjoy the podcast, please do us a favor and head to your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. It helps a ton. And there's a reason all the podcasts you listen to ask you to do this. We want to continue to encourage people in the middle of their difficult seasons, and your ratings help boost our podcast visibility and the stories of our guests. Did you pause it and leave a review? If so, thank you. All right. Back to our conversation.
So I think the way I have to answer it, being a fat, ugly kid, the only thing I ever wanted was for things to be easier. I wanted things to be easier. I was an obese teenager. I spent 10 years with an eating disorder. I lived plenty of life during that time. I don't have any, like, I was still living life. I wasn't, you know, in an institution or any of that. I was on my own, traveling all over the place. A lot of it was really fucked up, but the getting out of that on my own and coming out on the other side of that on my own, which, you know, again, I wouldn't recommend. I'm pretty stubborn. I probably should have, you know, asked for help, but I was on my own. What are you going to do? You're stubborn. You're doing it yourself. You're certainly not someone with health insurance that's going to go get anybody's help. I think the amount of just, well, that coupled with, sorry, I'm going to add something to that. So my brother and I come from, it was a very successful family business, but it all broke up around the time that we were like 8 years old. So everything was really chaotic. There wasn't really a home to go back to. And I want to say, I think all of the people involved are good humans and we're good players. But I think that things just don't always work out. So I think for a long time, probably until like my early 20s, I resented that, you know, there was never a landing pad, that there was never a home to go back to. Like, where's my college education? Where's my car? Like, just these things that seem really, they're not important. But when you're a kid and you have this idea of the trajectory of your life, you know, it would have been nice to have just, you know, not have been obese, to not have had the family be broken up, to not be out on my own so young. And now, holy fuck, that's my superpower. I absolutely would not give back the number of times I moved somewhere new and had no idea how I was going to pay rent. I had 3 jobs before I knew it. I was always employable. The number of times, like, I ended up at train stations with no more money and asked the nice lady if I could sweep the floor for $5. Like, every single one of those experiences that would scare a mom today, like, I wouldn't give any of that back because, like, the personal evolution you have to go through when you're building your own life from nothing, the personal evolution you have to go through when there's no one to rely on, there's no one to call. It feels at this point like a superpower because no one can take anything away from me that I can't get back, earn back. I always think of that Rudyard Kipling poem, If, which I know is meant for like men, but, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, if you can, I wish I could recite it, but, you know, if you can, if you can lose everything and know that you're going to be okay, to me, that's a superpower. Because as we spoke of before, the idea of security, security is a falsehood to begin with. There is no physical security. Just because you have insurance doesn't mean you're not going to get sick. You know, I feel very comfortable all by myself, and I feel very secure knowing that I know how to figure things out. I know how to get through things, and I know how to do it without needing to call for help. And I know that's really tangential, but I think I absolutely, my brother and I talk about this a lot. If we had been a part of the side of the family business that had stayed together and we had the college education and we had all the things that the cousins and everyone else had, we probably would hate ourselves. I don't know who my brother and I would be if our path had been easy. We wouldn't be as philosophically minded. We wouldn't be these people who were constantly diving deep to understand what it is to exist and be alive. So, you know, a really broad way of saying, I wouldn't want my childhood or my teenage years or my 20s to have been easy. I wouldn't want to have followed some conventional path where I got married at 20 and had kids and someone paid for a wedding and now I own a house. Most of the people I know who went that route are not so happy that they did that so young. So it just, I wouldn't give back things not being easy. They're still not easy. And I think now I make it that way.
Which is probably a little bit of a different approach than you took when you were a teenager.
No, very, very, very different. But I think, you know, I feel weird saying that because, you know, as we touched upon in the beginning, you know, I'm not from a war-torn country. I wasn't abused. I didn't lose a limb in a car accident. And yes, this is all relative, but I think it's important for people to understand that whatever difficult thing they've been through, it really does become your superpower. And it really does make you stronger. And it gives you this like pool of like grit and power to draw on, like David Goggins' cookie jar, that no one can take from you. And you can't buy it. I can't buy your life experience and put it in my cookie jar. You have to own whatever it, you know, whatever you've been through. I remember when I was still trying to like, you know, be nicer to my own brain. I remember I had to come up with this kind of mantra, like, and it was, I am who I am because of who and how I have been. I am who I am because of who and how I have been. And to me, that's important because we are all only ever our own current end result. And it's ever evolving, but it is composed of everything you've ever been through. So if you love anything about who you are now, you must unconditionally love everything every other iteration of you has been through. That's it. No exceptions. No exceptions. You must love every iteration of your previous self if you love anything about who you are, because any of that changes and you are not who you currently are. And I think so many people hold their past against themselves. I held that I was fat against myself. And then I held that I was anorexic against myself. And, you know, just the stupid things we do. We hold things against ourselves that we don't need to hold against ourselves. The world is difficult enough. You know, don't do that to yourself. Again, another tangent, but it took me years to get there. It took me years to just, this is me. And I'm not perfect and I never will be, but anything that I feel confident about today is a result of anything that I've been through in the past.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, thanks for sharing that. I'm curious about like cause you talked briefly at the beginning, a little bit about that, like Boston time and, you know, living in a library and, when you're talking about kind of the genesis of your care for all things brain.
Yes.
But I am curious, like when you think back prior to like that realization that you had agency.
Yes.
And that hard, for lack of a better term, season, you know, 8 years old, family business fell apart to 24, whenever it was that you're like, okay, I don't have to live this way anymore. Like what were the different paths to, I'll call it success, in in that longer season that you can remember wrestling and being pulled, you know, tugging back and forth on?
So what I will say, and I think of this fairly often, is that, you know, when I lived in Boston, you know, between working in a coffee shop in the morning and waitressing and bartending at night, I go to the library, I'd go to used bookstores, I'd buy all the old books, I'd go sit and I'd write. And I was really unhappy with certain patterns in my life. And so I would write down, and I don't know why I did this. I probably read that someone else did it, but I'd write down, you know, this is the day, this is my name, this is where I'm sitting. These are things I want to be that I'm not yet. These are things I want in my life that I don't have yet. And I kind of made a practice of that. And some of it was, you know, I want to live in a hut with a truck and a dog. Some of it was, you know, I was very specifically around, you know, I don't want to be engaged in this eating disorder anymore. Some of it was, I don't want to feel X anymore. And I made a practice of that over a long time. And there were times where I would feel like, why am I doing this? I'm still this person, like nothing's changed. Yeah. But what I didn't yet have enough time on the planet to understand is that these are very long-term things. They change little bits over time. And I remember, so when I was 24, I was tired of Boston, flew to Colorado, lived in Colorado for like a month, took a bus to Santa Barbara, where my brother lived. And that's how I ended up there. And, you know, I had nothing, didn't know what I was going to do. My brother and I ended up getting a place to live together. And we would do these long walks to coffee shops. Neither of us had a car for a while. And I remember like 3 or 4 years in, we were on a walk and I just was giggling to myself because I remembered all these things I'd written down 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And it was like magic. I was those things. I had attained those things. And I thought it felt like magic, but what I realized is that what I was doing is like I was forming an intention and a path for myself. And even though it didn't feel like every moment of every day, I was like, okay, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? How are you going to change this? It didn't matter because it was already embedded in my brain from the time that I had written it down. And, you know, lo and behold, year over year over year, I kept becoming those things I wanted to become, but it is an evolution. It is not a quick process. We have really deeply embedded, you know, they talk about it with using psilocybin. When you have any sort of addictive behavior, whether it's an actual addiction to a substance or it's an addiction to like just self-talk that's negative, there are deep grooves. The best way to think about it, it scared one of my ex-boyfriends, but so think of a set of behaviors. Think of when I lived in Boston, there would always be trees in the winter, right? That had just the big, beautiful silhouettes with all of the branches everywhere. So think of one of those trees as a behavior that you don't want to participate in anymore, but it's strong, right? So the only way to get out of that behavior pattern is to stop feeding it. So ever so slowly, each of those branches gets smaller. And then over here, you've got a seed. You don't even have a tree yet, right? So this is what you want to be over here, but it's a seed dry on the ground. It's not even sprouted. So the process of slowly not feeding this very well embedded set of behaviors is very slow. And the process of growing this little seed over here requires you not feeding this and feeding this instead. And it takes a lot of time. And for me, I kind of visualize like growing new neural networks for the positive set of behaviors while slowly letting this other thing die. And It's not quick or easy. That's why, you know, with psilocybin, they're finding that's really helpful for post-traumatic stress disorder, for therapy purposes, because it quickens the brain's ability to get out of those neurochemical ruts and basically gives people a step out so that they see that they can grow that new network of neural connections. Mm-hmm. I know that, again, that was a roundabout thing.
No, it made sense. I like the tree analogy because, you know, I mentioned I have four little kids and they're similarly, like, I want them to just like all of a sudden be these like fully formed adult humans that can like have empathy for people and just understand that patience is a valuable thing and like that they can wait for mom and dad's attention and all these things. But it's like, no, I have to train them like 100,000 times. You know, like I have to like continue to like send these, you know, these little neurons down this pathway and get it deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And it is like a slow process. It's growing a tree, which you don't notice the tree growing when you look at it. It's like you have to look away for a while and then come back and be like, oh,
it's the same with ourselves. And that to me, I think if anything, try and note when you have achieved a thing that you wanted to achieve. And I don't care if it's, you always wanted to run and now you're running 1 mile a day. That's huge. Take a moment to go, oh, I did that thing. What else can I do? What else do I want to try? Because that, my brother and I do this all the time. We're still hard on ourselves. Like we do and we do and we do, but then the plate gets full again and we feel like we've done nothing. And we're both like, man, are we getting anywhere? And we literally have to stop and have a whiskey together and go, oh, this has been a crazy few years. We have done X, Y, and Z. It's like, we, these days especially, I don't think we stop enough. Like, I don't know the last time I went for a 4-hour walk, but in Boston, I walked all day and I thought all day and I read all day. And before I had a car and a fancy job and all the other things, I had all this time to just like marinate and think and just try and figure life out. And now, you know, I'm living three lives at once and it's good, but I have to try to stop myself and go, you know what? No, you may not, no, you can't do a muscle up yet. And you maybe you never will, but you show up every day. Like whatever the situation is, I don't think we stop to give ourselves enough credit for the milestones that we've hit, especially the ones that where we're the only ones who would know, because it was an internal metric we were trying to hit. It's not getting on a stage and lifting a bunch of weight and everybody else saying a thing. That's not the same as us acknowledging that we did a hard thing and we can do more of them. And it's like doing hard things sounds like Goggins and big and sexy, but it's the little things and they start internally and it can and will lead to those big, sexy, scary things like 4x4x48, which I think I've agreed to doing and I don't want to do again. But I think it's important for people to understand that because I think some people get turned off, like, especially, you know, as a female, I feel like I kind of have more of a male voice. Cause I'm like, I joke that I should have been a Navy SEAL because it's going to be hard for me to work for most woke companies because it's like, come on, let's go. You can do this. You can fucking do this. I'm here for you. You are stronger than you think you are. You're not allowed to really do that anymore, but right. I think that there's a certain population of people who are, they do hard things, rubs them the wrong way. And it's, to me, so sad because it's for everyone. It's a part of being human. You don't have to be high testosterone, muscled, aggro. You don't know. Like the hard thing could be starting your knitting company. That's hard.
Totally. Or so, learning how to knit.
I'd rather probably, yeah, no. So I think that's one thing that I wish people understood is that it's I don't know how to say it because I absolutely love David Goggins and I love Joe Rogan and like they're my archetypical.
It's not a hoorah culture. It's not for the few and the proud and the like extremely capable. It's for you where you sit right now. And you look at like where you could grow and the like tension and the friction that has to exist there and you say yes to it.
Yes.
Or you find that life is forcing you into that situation. And instead of considering yourself a victim to it, you think, okay, what can I get from this?
That right there is that's the crux of it is There's no blame to be had in life. There's only responsibility to be taken. And people take that the wrong way. If you know someone who has cancer, I'm absolutely not saying I'm blaming you for getting cancer. What I'm saying is, what are the facts of today? If the facts of today are that this injury or this cancer exists, how do we take ownership with the knowledge we have and move forward powerfully? Yeah. That's all that means. It's not about...
I talked to a guy who, he was a triple amputee, and he became a triple amputee when he was like 21. Okay. And what he said that I'll never forget is, you know, it's really hard to adjust to life with one arm and no legs after having lived that long with him. And he said he, you know, every day he'd wake up and he'd be like trying to do a thing, you know, maybe it's brush his teeth or tie a shoe or eat food, and he'd think, man, I used to do it this way and I can't anymore. And he'd get so upset and frustrated. And he said he had this like light bulb moment where he realized, like, well, when I was a baby, I didn't know how to use my two arms, my two legs. Like, I had to figure out how to do the things I needed to do with what I had. And he's like, now I'm just like a new baby. I just got to go, okay, all I've got now is one arm. How do I do this thing with one arm? Yep. And it was just like this mindset shift of, okay, here are the facts for my current situation. How do I move through life now? Not like how I used to, but now.
Extreme. It's that extreme ownership. And to me, the first piece of that is just that. I wish, oh, what if, or what if things were, what are you working with? Start there, because everything else is literally a waste of the only currency that matters while we exist, which is time. That's the only currency of value, because it goes away and then we are done. So how much of your finite amount of this currency of time do you want to give away to X? Whether it's your own pity party or negative people in your life, we have to own, well, we don't have to, people don't, but in an ideal scenario, we're aware of how we spend our life's time. And what he said is amazing, and that he came to that is massive, because now he knows the toolbox he's working with, and he's not going to have magical dreams about other toolboxes. Maybe Elon Musk will solve that. Maybe Neuralink will solve that for him. But the toolbox is this until there's a new tool in there. And you're just torturing yourself if you play these games, these magical thinking games. I'm not big into magical thinking. I don't believe in hope. I'm kind of like an optimistic nihilist. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad
thing. How can you be an optimist and not believe in hope?
I think it's a language issue, and I think it's a definitions issue, because I wouldn't say I'm optimistic or hopeful at all. I am action oriented, and I understand that I can dream all day and hope for that house in Montana that I want to live in and that job that lets me do that thing. But I think I just intimately understand that I'd rather focus on what's right in front of me that will ultimately get me there. So I'd rather have like a vague idea of where I would like to end up in the physical world, but put all of the focus on making sure that I am living in a way today to the best of my ability with the resources available to me to know that I'm on that trajectory. And I think I don't like the idea of hope, because I'm not going to leave things that are within my power to choose up to chance. And then if something does come in that would have felt like hope for something, for someone else, if an opportunity does come around, it's like, it's one of the four agreements. It is basically, you know, if compliments, don't take things people say to you personally. So someone could call me a dirtbag or someone could call me beautiful. Neither should affect me. neither should affect me. And I think that's kind of how I feel about those magical words. I think that the optimistic nihilism thing comes from a conversation I had with my tattoo artist. And basically his thought was, the most hopeful people in the world are the ones that wind up become nihilists, because they keep putting hope into everyone. They keep thinking, oh, humans are better, they're going to change. And you know, I so deeply believe that everyone can change. It gets frustrated when they get scared when they get scared in a conversation with me, if I come off too strong about how they can change, how they can evolve, how they can grow, that there does come a point of frustration where you're like, okay, maybe not. Maybe it's a select number of people who can grow. So I think language is flawed. And I think I might just have an issue with how those terms are thrown around and defined. I think if they
that's totally fine. Because it does sound, I think you're right. Because we all kind of have different ways that we understand concepts. And so, but it sounds like, you know, there is, to use the word hope in what I'm saying, not because I think that you should, but because this is the only way I know how to describe it. It sounds like there is a hope in, like, the present moment, that I can do and be the things that are required of me now, and that will have a benefit for later. And not in a, like, to achieve X, but in a, like, to be greater or better than now, like, to move in a positive trajectory.
Yeah. And that's where I'd say, I think that, I think the word can be wielded in many ways. And I think why I have such a response to with that word is it's not an action word. And I feel that to evolve and to change and to get what we want out of life, there's effort involved and there's discipline involved and there's, choosing involved. And to me, those words are the opposite of the hope word. But yeah. I would say that you could say, I would hope that my choices and my efforts and my discipline are going to help me get to a place that I would like to be. So I could use it in that way.
yeah, totally. And you don't need to if you don't want to. I don't know what other word to use in this moment. I guess you could pursue or, but yes. Regardless, I was like, how can you? Okay, you explained it. all right, so I want to ask you, I ask everybody this before we wrap up. I feel like you gave some great advice for people, first of all. I'll just acknowledge that throughout the conversation. But I want to ask, because I think, and you've made this comment, that like hard things are just a part of life. They're not like, it's not like everybody's guaranteed their one hard moment and then you're like cruising the rest of life. Like, generally speaking, it's a roller coaster. There's seasons, just like, so all that context to ask this question, what is a hard thing you're in the middle of right now?
So the hard thing I'm in the middle of right now is my fancy job is coming to an end, and I'm still about 2 years away. My brother does hope, I don't. We're probably less than 2 years away. We're in my mind, we're about 2 years away from us not having to work other jobs and just run our business. So, you know, one of the hard things right now is I'm working this job until the end of March. So I need to give 100% to those hours, while giving 100% to finding a new job and 100% to Keto Brains, because we keep running out of product. We can't keep up with production. So we're trying to move to a full turnkey facility. So really just trying to remain balanced in this moment where so much is up in the air. And obviously so much of what we talked about today has been on my mind in these past few weeks. It's been a long, I've never had a job title dissolved before. Like, I've been working since I was 12 and I've never had a job just go away. So that's a new thing for me. And, just processing all of that and not letting it affect how I move through the day, and just trusting and knowing. So maybe that's, I use trust instead of hope. I trust that I'm going to find the necessary employment. I'm trusting the process with our small business, and just trusting the process with finishing up my current job and doing it well and doing it strongly for my current employer, and just trying to balance being those three people in a time where everything's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. So it's a big moment of transition, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Part of me just wants to do the thing you hear all the entrepreneurs say, like, your business is never gonna scale X number until you don't have that other job. So part of me is like, okay, that's the sign. This is the go button. And the other part of me is trying to be really practical. And so I'm going back and forth between being super practical and just getting another job and continuing to run Keto Braids on the weekends, and just pushing hard to grow Keto Braids even faster and spending all of my time on it. So
yeah.
Processing things and figuring out the right move.
Yeah. And I'm sure even when you decide to make a decision, you're going to be like, well, there's always going to be that maybe what if this, and so you're just going to have to like
roll with it,
for it one way or the other. Yeah, man, that sounds like a lot to reflect on and process and think through. So I hope that you get some good insights and wisdom in the next couple of weeks or 6 weeks or so. And
yes,
I'm sure you'll be able to make a wise choice. It sounds like the business is growing, which is really cool. And I hope that makes your decision easier in the next 6 weeks, even too. That might.
It's a big part of what is decided, for sure.
Yeah.
So
it's
forcing me to think sooner about what it looks like to do that 100% of the time. And maybe that's the decision I'm going to make. Still.
Well, I know you didn't ask me for any advice, but I'll throw an idea in your court for you. Just because you said you haven't taken a 4-hour walk in a long time.
Oh,
and you have this kind of like really great season in Boston where you were, working at a coffee shop and had a slower pace of life. Maybe for a little bit, it's just a coffee shop season, and some extra employment, from the coffee shop, but then you've got more time for the business at the same time and lots of time to think. So I don't know.
I
know you didn't ask for it, but.
No, it honestly sounds magical. It's like, I get to make that shift in my head, like to have a simpler life for a minute might be neat, but it also, who knows?
It's no director of innovation. I will be the first to acknowledge that, because
it's not all it's cracked up.
Coffee shops need that. So
not all it's cracked up to be, and plenty of innovation I can do for my company. So
that's probably very true. Well, yeah. Molly, for people that, are curious more about Keto Braids or just want to stay in touch with like what's going to happen with Molly, where can people follow you or the company and the business?
I have no social media personally. I got rid of it all like 10 years ago, but Keto Braids, you can find us on Instagram. Our website is Keto Braids. It's KetoBraiNZ. On Instagram and on our website. And we do, you'll see us in those mediums. And you can find Kyle actually at Head and Heart Photography. He's amazing. He's a phenomenal photographer, an amazing human. He'll answer your questions about crypto and NFTs and take amazing photos. So he's worth
it. What a dream guy. Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that. I'll put that stuff in the show notes for people.
I am
very thankful to have had a chance to hear some of your story, and thanks for being willing to go there. I appreciate it, Molly.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. We hope you are encouraged today and have a newfound hope to persevere. Be sure to subscribe for more great episodes and conversations. And if you ever want to watch an episode, check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/elitesrs. Have a blessed day.